Jacksonville, once the seat of Jackson County, celebrates Chinese New Year this weekend, which gives us a chance to not only talk about the celebrations, but about Chinese communities in the region in some of the old years, like in the 19th century. The West welcomed Chinese immigrants for years, then feelings and laws turned against the immigrants. We'll explore the new and the old in this month's installment of Underground History. That's our joint project with the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, here and after referred to as SULA. Chelsea Rose is a SULA researcher back in the studio with me once again. Chelsea, good to see you.
Hi, good to be here.
And on the phone, two guests. Don Merritt is the museum curator at the Kam Wah Chung State Heritage Site in John Day, Oregon. Hi, Don.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Good to have you here. And David Lay is with us as well. He is, there's a lot of titles we can give David Lay. Historian, dancer, art patron, board member of the Center for Asian American Media at UC Berkeley, and along with Chelsea, one of the speakers at this weekend's Chinese New Year celebrations. David Lay, thank you for joining us as well.
Yes, Gong Hei Fa Choi.
Oh, thank you very much. That was a Happy New Year wish, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk about you first. You're actually an immigrant from Taiwan, is that correct?
Correct. I came here 60 years ago, a full Chinese cycle.
That is, in other words, you get all the years in there?
Yes, combination of the animal plus the five elements. So it's 60 years.
All right. So one of the things that Chelsea and I were talking about coming in here is that Jacksonville actually chooses to celebrate the end of the Chinese New Year. Since it is a Lunar New Year, it's actually about 4 weeks of celebrations. Is that right?
Yes, it's actually 15 days, the official, but many of the associations celebrate after the first 15 years, have a banquet and family reunion and everything else, because the first 15 days, stores are closed, restaurants are closed, traditionally, so you got together at restaurants after all of them open up and all the businesses open up.
And Chelsea Rose, for the folks who don't know Jacksonville well and wonder why Jacksonville is celebrating Chinese New Year, give us the brief sketch there.
Well, Jacksonville was settled because of gold. So a lot of Chinese migrants came in, like folks from around the world, as gold miners in the 1850s. And there was a sizable Chinese community there. It's said to be the earliest Chinese urban community in the Pacific Northwest. And there was a bustling neighborhood there until the late 1880s. And it's no longer there. And so it's really been fantastic the past 10 years to have the Chinese New Year Festival back, because it was historically a big part of living in Jacksonville and a celebration that not only was important to the Chinese community, but you can see photographs of white neighbors also participating and looking on. So
a couple of decades then of Chinese New Year celebrations when there was a Chinese community in Jacksonville.
Yeah, definitely started in the mid-19th century, and you can see accounts up into the turn of the century when there's not a large population left, which means that it remained an important community event.
So Chinese communities scattered across the West account, Don Merritt, I would think, for the presence of the Kam Wah Chung State Heritage Site. Give us a little sketch there.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. And for the John Day area, Kam Wah Chung was actually established sometime in the late 1860s, early 1870s, and it really came into prominence when two Chinese individuals bought the existing Kam Wah Chung store, which means a golden flower of prosperity, is what the rough translation is. And in roughly about 1870s, that's when Dot-Kay, as we like to refer to him, and Lung An, he was the business partner of Dot-Kay. And they purchased the store, and they ran it all the way up until after 1940s. And that's when about the time that Lung An passed away, and Dot-Kay stayed on until about a little bit later on for a couple years after that. And then they ended up closing the store in 1948. But we have a complete history of all their transactions, their dates, and they were very prominent and very active, not only in the Chinese community, but for all the residents of the John Day and Grant County area.
So, but you've got then a complete place that existed nonstop from the time that Chinese people first settled there until well into this century, which is, I would think, unusual for the state of Oregon.
It is, and in fact, it's unusual for the whole country as well. In fact, it was so remarkable that in 2007, that the Kamwa Chung building or the museum was listed as a National Historic Landmark, and which is a high praise.
So what's there? What exists? What buildings are still there at the Kamwa Chung State Heritage Site?
It's actually only the one building. It's a stone building that we think was constructed in the 1860s, early 1860s, with the founding of the gold. And it was in place at the time that Dot K and Long An purchased it. And they ran a store or an herbal center, and it was also their place of residence. And they actually put up borders for the Chinese community within there as well. They had a kitchen. Its own little central community. And during that time that the Chinese were there, it was very influential. In fact, Long An, he seemed to manage all the Chinese affairs around in the county. And he would even get a hold of lawyers if there's any legal issues that was going on. They did run an opium den out of there, and they also kind of helped build community relations even with the white folks by providing services in stores and medical services that was really non-existent back at that time through there. And roughly about 1940, when Long An passed away and Dot K was still there, when they closed it up, everything from the 1880s up until 1940s, all their information, their documents, letters, medical records, cans of food, offerings for their temples, everything was still in place like a time capsule.
Wow, that was lucky that they kept things then, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, very for sure. And, in fact, there was so much stuff when they opened the building in 1976 back up that they think they were actually kind of hoarded because you could barely walk through there.
Mm-hmm. So how was it that that Ing Dok Hae and Lung An managed to hold on and stay in that part of Oregon as long as they did?
Well, everything, it seems to point to Lung An. He was very smart. He actually also knew how to write and speak English that the other Chinese folks did not. He was very proficient at it, and he could write very well. He had really good handwriting and penmanship, and he could talk real clear English, and so he was like the mediator between the Chinese community and the Euro-American folks that lived here. And he was very business savvy. And so he would purchase mines that the miners would abandon. He would purchase them and then sell them back to the Chinese miners, and they would work them and get more money that way. But everything seemed to focus around Long An because of his business sense and his knowledge. And he even was, in the 1920s, he even bought the very first auto store here in Eastern Oregon.
You mean the first car dealership?
The first car dealership in Eastern Oregon was purchased and run by Long An. Yeah.
Wow. That is amazing. Don Merritt is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the museum curator at the Kamwa Chung State Heritage Site in John Day. He is part of a broader discussion about Chinese communities in Oregon as part of this month's Underground History segment. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology is with me as well. She'll be speaking at Chinese New Year celebrations in Jacksonville this weekend, as will David Lay, who's a historian, dancer, art patron, board member of the Center for Asian American Media at UC Berkeley. So you can join this conversation about Chinese communities in Oregon back a century and a half and more. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Chelsea, is there anything comparable in Jacksonville? I mean, Kamwa Chung sounds so well preserved. Is there any, given the number of old buildings there, is there any place you can point to in Jacksonville and say, this is where Chinese people hung out?
No. The Jacksonville Chinese neighborhood did not survive. The buildings in there. The Kamwa Chung site is such a treasure for anybody interested in this topic because there's so much stuff intact. There's all the medicines that not everything's even been translated to date, I don't think. But there's also a lot of documents that some similar documents of like immigration documents and work documents in California were lost in fires. So it's an important resource. What we found in Jacksonville was a house that burned down. And And so we have a similar type of assemblage, but we had to do a lot more work to try to tease it out because, it, of course, it was burned and all the artifacts were fragmented. But we kind of have a similar thing, and so that's been exciting for us to kind of have another window into the daily life of Chinese residents in Southern Oregon during the height of the exclusion era, which this was the 1880s, which our house burned down at. And one of the things that I think is really important to emphasize both in the Jacksonville community and also at Camwa Chung is a lot of times when people talk about Chinese immigrants that were mining or working in the railroads, there's this kind of stereotype that they're kind of fresh off the boat foreigners, you know, and part of the fuel that kind of led to this Exclusion Act was this idea that they were foreigners always. They never were becoming American citizens. And in Jacksonville and in Camwa Chung, these are folks that lived in these towns for 20, 30, 40 years. I mean, you know, longer in Jacksonville than some of their white neighbors by the time the 1880s rolled around because they were some of the first residents there. So, you know, it's a really different the reality of what life was like for these Chinese Americans, you know, was lost in history. And it's really important for us to be able to tell that story and kind of bring that story back to light.
David Lay, you're actually working on a documentary about the Chinese Exclusion Act, aren't you?
Yes, I am. The 1882 Exclusion Law. But the important story behind that is the pushback by the Chinese that were here. They didn't think of themselves so much as victims. But they hired the best lawyer money could buy, and took the U.S. government to court. More than 10,000 lawsuits, with a population of only 110,000 Chinese in America. That's like 9% of the Chinese in America at that time, between 1882 and 1905, sued the government, and more than 20 of them went to the Supreme Court, and winning for all Americans. Concepts such as equal protection under the law, right to a public education, and what makes you an American. Birthright citizenship, which is coming back again, was an important Supreme Court case, Wong Kim Art versus the U.S., because he was born in the U.S., left before the exclusion law. When he tried to come back after the Chinese exclusion law, the customs people, immigration people, says, oh, you're Chinese, you can't come back in. He said, I was born here in America. That makes me a citizen. And it had to go to the Supreme Court to make that decision for birthright citizenship.
And so he did finally prevail on that?
Yes, he prevailed. And now we have this birthright citizenship for America. And only about 30 countries in the world have this birthright citizenship, that if you're born there, you're a citizen.
I'm struck by what Chelsea was just talking about, though, about the exclusion laws coming into effect at a time when some people had lived in their communities for decades and longer than the white people near them who resented them being there. I mean, is that fairly common around the West?
Well, yes. All of America, from the very beginning, what made you a citizen was a white landowner, as it was in Great Britain. So we have a tradition of that. It was later on we've added more and more people. It was the 14th Amendment after the Civil War that blacks, Native Americans were made citizens. But the Chinese were picked out in 1882 to be totally excluded, that if you were Chinese, you cannot be a naturalized citizen. And if you, with very few exceptions, you were unable to come to America.
What changed? What was it that led up to the feelings that led to the passage of that law?
Well, it was in the 1870s, there was a recession and competition for jobs. The Chinese were known as very hardworking and willing to work for less, and it was competition for jobs. And what really triggered it was California was the swing vote in the 1880s or late 1870s for the presidential election. And since California had this issue with the Chinese competing for jobs, Congress, wanting that sixth vote for the president, passed this exclusion law. And it wasn't until 2012 that Congress, both houses of Congress, pass a regret for doing this.
I was going to ask if there have been reparations or resolutions of regret. So it took until 2012, you're saying, to get
that? Yes, regret, not an apology, because apology comes with some compensation. But it was a regret that this was done.
And so give us a sense, Chelsea Rose, about as the Exclusion Act came into effect in the early 1880s, what kinds of things happened to the people in Jacksonville? Did this, in fact, result in the removal of the Chinese community there?
Well, Jacksonville, you know, Southern Oregon's kind of an interesting case because in the 1880s, we're still building railroads. So Chinese labor force is still an important and highly coveted group. So they're coming in to help work on the California-Oregon.
That's true, which is about 20 years behind the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there are still jobs. But at that point, the community is kind of shifting from Jacksonville to Ashland. And what that does, what the Exclusion Act does, is it makes it harder for folks to go back and forth from China, to come in from China, to bring their families over from China. It also kind of sanctions violence and discrimination towards the Chinese population, so it became a lot more dangerous, especially for folks in more rural areas. So there was some appeal to leaving and going towards larger urban centers. In addition to Jacksonville, in general, was in decline because the railroad went to Medford. So there's kind of a depression there. So the community in Jacksonville becomes really small. However, the members that survive in that community that live there for the rest of their lives, you know, they were there for 50, 60 years and definitely part of the community. But the, you know, the bigger, I think, thing is that the Exclusion Act kind of, and the way that people moved after that, it kind of led to the whitewashing of the history. So people forget how big of a contribution the Chinese made to the development of Oregon in general, but certainly Southern Oregon, building roads, building the big infrastructure that led to the, you know, sustained population here. They paid taxes, more taxes than their white neighbors because they had the foreign miners tax. They had special fees and licenses they had to get to have businesses. So they made a huge financial contribution in addition to some of the other things they worked on. But again, you know, their story hasn't really been told.
David Lay, how much did Chinese Americans of that time make it clear that the things that Chelsea's talking about, like, hey, we pay a lot to be here. We're actually providing a lot of help to your community.
Well, for the most part, they were happy to be here making maybe 100 times the wages they were making in China. And China was going through civil wars, a lot of disturbances at the time. So they were glad for this opportunity. They didn't like the fact that they had to pay more taxes. There were plenty of taxes and fees that the Chinese pay for. In California, it's estimated that they pay more than half of all the income of California during its formative years.
Wow.
So, but they survived, and some did very well, like Doc Hay, in John Day. In fact, I feel the legacy at John Day was that are the survivors that Doc Hay cured. I think there was a Carolyn Mishmer there at one time. Don, maybe you can talk about that, that wrote about Doc Hay's contribution, how he was the doctor for the whole area, because Western medicine at that time was way behind.
Yes, and following up on that point is that we have records and we even have oral interviews from people that were treated by Doc Hay back when they were kids in the, even in back, as far back as the 1920s. And Doc Hay's influence for Western medicine was reached all the way as far as Texas and the Dakotas, and there was one case that a person from Minnesota traveled all the way here to try to get a cure. And because the Chinese medicine and their herbal treatments was far more advanced than the Western world doctors at the time. And so his influence was quite substantial. His sphere, his influence was always, like I said, even in the Canada at times, people were coming down to get treatment by Doc Hay because of his reputation. And there's has not been any recorded documents that his treatments did not work. They were so popular.
So, Don, were there any incidents? I mean, I have to believe there were some over the years where Doc Hay and Lung On were subject to discrimination in John Day and elsewhere in Eastern Oregon.
Oh, yes, they were. In fact, during the Exclusion Act, they, for Campbell & Chung at the building, they actually put in steel plates on their doors and windows and put in bars to keep the upset miners from attacking. I guess every few nights a group of miners would get all worked up and go into Chinatown and start shooting up. In fact, there's still bullet holes in the door right now that you can still see today for where people were shooting into the building. And also during that time, even all the way up in the past the 1900, they were still being arrested for owning property and for providing services. The unique thing with John Day, though, because of Doc Hay and Long Ong's popularity in the public, they were usually released within just a couple days because they had enough influence with lawyers to be released.
Sure, as pillars of the community. Had they ever become citizens?
They actually did become citizens. The one that I know for sure is Long Ong became a citizen in 1897.
Uh-huh. Okay, wow. So 15 years after the Exclusion Act. We'll get more into talking about the history of Chinese people in Oregon. We're talking to Don Merritt from the Kam Wah Chung State Heritage Site. We have Chelsea Rose from Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and historian David Lay all with us. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange and continue this discussion. You're welcome to join us by phone or by email. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Thirty-six on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Check us out online at jeffexchange.org. Follow us on Facebook. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. And take part in our conversation as it happens. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're continuing a discussion about Chinese immigrants in the West with a focus on Oregon in the 19th century. Jacksonville celebrates Chinese New Year this weekend. That city once had a thriving Chinese community, as did many in the West. Then came Chinese exclusion laws, a big one in 1882 in particular. We're still digging into that history today, and in some cases digging quite literally. Three guests are with us. Chelsea Rose is with us for our monthly Underground History segment. She is a researcher at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, which we generally just call SULA. Don Merritt is the museum curator at the Kam Wah Chung State Heritage Site in John Day, Oregon, and David Lay is a historian and more. David and Chelsea will be speaking at Chinese New Year celebration in Jacksonville this weekend. Again, you're welcome to join us as we talk about Chinese history in the West. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. I was looking, David, at some of the video components you have online. Mm-hmm. About Chinese occupation in the West and the Chinese Exclusion Act. And there was an interesting part there where you consider the dragon not just as a Chinese symbol, but also as a symbol of America.
Yes. Well, the dragon is a mythological animal for the Chinese, but is the most powerful. It's the only mythological animal in the Chinese zodiac of 12 animals. But is a composite animal. It has the antlers of a deer, mouth of a camel, scales of a carp, a body of a serpent, talons of an eagle, legs of a tiger, and so on and so on. The best parts of all the animals comprise, make up the dragon, which is then the most powerful. So it's really saying if you borrow the best or adopt the best from all cultures, you become the most powerful. And that's the image we have. True integration and true diversity makes you strong and powerful.
Why does that get forgotten, do you think, so often in America? I mean, you can look at the Chinese exclusion laws, you can look at the Jim Crow laws that followed on their heels, and a number of other ways in which the people who were here already decided that the people who came just behind them shouldn't be here.
Well, politics, economics, that normally falls in. When the economy's bad, you look for some reason, and certain times certain groups are picked out because they're easy And to get the vote, stay in power, and so on, you make certain adjustments, beliefs. You don't stay with some of your values.
Short term, were the exclusion laws successful? I mean, they did exclude Chinese people, and did the law result in the decimation of the Chinese communities across the West, like the one in Jacksonville?
Well, the good thing about our system here is we have three branches of the government. It was the legislative branch and the executive branch that were very tough on the Chinese. But the Chinese soon found out that the courts, playing by the rules of the court, which has a long history from Britain, if you play by the rules, you could get in, existing rules. And about 80% of the Chinese that sued the government got in.
Wow, that's quite a success rate. Now, did that extend to other ethnic groups, or did it stop with Chinese people?
No, that I don't know for sure, but the Japanese did that later on. The Japanese were excluded, the Filipinos were excluded, and we have many, many of these cases documented. And like I said before, more than 20 of the cases that the Chinese brought up, not only on immigration but on civil rights, went to the Supreme Court from the 1880s. And the Chinese won many of these that are current laws about immigration and civil rights.
So, Chelsea, how difficult is it to find things? I mean, you pretty much got broken fragments as the history of Chinese occupancy in Jacksonville, aside from photographs, which fortunately were around at the time Chinese people were as well. But has it been difficult over the years to piece together a good record of what happened where, and more importantly, who were the players?
It is, because a lot of the documents that we have are written, you know, by the white people that ran the newspapers, that took the census records, all those kind of documents. And so they're biased in, you know, like any document is a biased document. But it's really hard to get at the Chinese perspective. We only have one Chinese written document from Jacksonville. I'm sure there were more, but they didn't end up in the repositories like the newspaper archives and stuff like that. So it's hard to see their side of the story. Scholars are starting to work more and more with other scholars in China, which is great, because then we're getting the other perspective, the letters home, the, you know, the view from the families. A lot of the folks that came over to work in California and Oregon and the West in the early days, they had families at home. And so there's a lot of communication there that is, you know, largely untapped. That's exciting. But for the most part, in the U.S., it's tricky because of these exclusion acts. Folks were driven more and more underground, and that's metaphorically, of course. But what happens is you also get a lot of urban legends. And you know, and I think in some ways this led to the whole idea of the Chinese living in tunnels and in
like the Shanghai tunnels in Portland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually no evidence that they lived in those tunnels, and most of those, they're not even tunnels. They're the service entrance, you know, to bring supplies and kegs of stuff.
The stairs up to the sidewalk to get stuff off the truck.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's another way, another legacy of this discrimination and racism towards this population is thinking that they lived underground like rats. And in fact, like David's been pointing out, the Chinese did not sit by and passively take all this. They resisted and persisted, and they thrived in a lot of communities. And just like anybody else, if there wasn't economic opportunity in a small town like Jacksonville anymore, they moved somewhere else. John Day was unique in that it's a rural area, but it kind of was a haven because of these two prominent figures, that a lot of people could live there throughout the exclusion era and be successful in that small town. But for the most part, folks ended up in the cities.
Don Merritt, in John Day, how long did Doc Hay and Lung An live?
They actually moved in, if we think, roughly in the early part of the 1870s when they came into the United States. We just don't have any real proof that exactly when they got here, but we do know that they purchased the Campbell Chung store roughly about 1875-76, and they stayed in that building all the way until their Lung An's death around 1940. Mm-hmm. And Doc Hay, he stuck around until about 1944, and then he had a problem with his hip But he lived for another 4 years in Portland at a medical facility there until he passed away.
I guess I was wondering if there was a big funeral for either one of them. Would there possibility would have been there for Lung An? Was there one?
Yes. In fact, their funerals, particularly with Lung An's, is that it was a Mason's funeral. And so they were so prominent in the community here that they were actually members of the Mason Society. And so they actually had Mason funerals for them.
So they really had become pillars of the community in a big way.
Yes, they have. And they actually also helped assist them with other burials for the Chinese and helped raise funds to send those people back home, back to China on a lot of occasions.
David Lay, I was just looking at it. It looks like just within the past few years that California passed a law requiring the teaching of the Exclusion Act. Are you up to speed on that one?
No, that I'm not aware of.
Okay. What do you know, though, if anything, about what is taught in school about things like exclusion laws and just basically racist attitudes that existed in the country through the years?
I think that depends on the teacher. Here in California, there's only a requirement of 2 weeks of teaching East Asian history and culture during the seventh grade. That's the California requirement, and that's about it. And up to the teacher, normally, what is taught during those 2 weeks.
How long did exclusion laws stay on the books in America?
Oh, to 1943, when China, during World War II, China was an ally of the U.S., Great Britain, against Japan and Germany and Italy. So someone asked, how come you don't let your ally into your country? So Congress, in his wisdom in 1943, changed that and allowed 105 Chinese a year from around the world to come into the United States. My family of six, my parents took us here. We came in 1956 and took up 5% of that quota, that year's quota. It's like winning, yeah, it's like winning the lottery six times over.
Wow. So interesting timing, though. So we began to make amends with Chinese citizens or Chinese people in 1943, when by 1942 we'd begun locking up Japanese Americans.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you see any parallels with the recent immigration moves of the Trump administration to what happened back in the 1880s?
Oh, yes. There's parallel. We're talking about the same issue. Who gets to come? Who doesn't get to come? What makes you an American?
All right. Let's talk about the actual Chinese New Year celebration. We talked already about the fact that it could be celebrated for a long period of time. In Jacksonville, essentially, Chelsea Rose is celebrating the back end of the Chinese New Year.
Yeah. So there's the celebrations this weekend. There'll be a parade and a lot of different exhibits. And we're going to be talking about the archaeology that we've done there. And what we try to do is kind of bring the neighborhood back to life and talk about the individuals that made up the neighborhood. Because a lot of times when people think about Chinese communities in little towns like Jacksonville, it's kind of a monolithic group, when in reality it was a lot of diversity of people from different villages and spoke different regional dialects in some cases and, you know, made up of individuals. So anytime we can kind of individuate that story and try to make it more personal to Jacksonville, that's pretty exciting for us. So
to make it something other than the Chinese.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, individuals. Don Merritt, I didn't ask if there's any sort of Chinese New Year celebration at Kam Wah Chung State Heritage Site in John Day.
At this point, there is not currently anything scheduled. Back when that was first became a state heritage site back in 2006, they did do a celebration, I think, in 2007. But since then, we have not had the opportunity, but that's something that we're trying to work with the community to try to get more interest back in for doing these kind of different programs.
David Lay, what do you make of communities like Jacksonville where there's a mixed history with Chinese Americans and now they're celebrating Chinese New Year?
Oh, I think it's wonderful to have this diversity, celebrate all cultures. But you need a core group of people, a real community to push for it and to do all the work, fundraising, and the execution of all these programs. So I think it's wonderful that Jacksonville has a core group that is doing this.
Now, it's not just the history of exclusion and Chinese Americans in the West that you're talking about. I noticed that your talk on Saturday at 1 o'clock at the U.S. Hotel Ballroom is called Am I a Rooster or a Monkey? Evidently, there gets to be some confusion about the Chinese zodiac and which year is which.
Oh, yes. The calendar, well, time is relative. What determines the beginning of the year, first day of the year, and so on, is very mixed up, even in the West, Julian calendar, the Gregorian calendar, because you're talking about a day, which is 24 hours, a month, which is lunar. You look at the full moon and so on, traditionally, and then a year, which is the solar movement. And the Chinese calendar is really not a lunar calendar. It's a combination of the lunar and solar. So it's a moving target, just like we have here in the West Easter. What is next year's Easter? You have to calculate the equinox, the spring equinox, and then from that, the next full moon, next full moon, uh-huh. And the Sunday after that full moon.
So the Easter could be anywhere basically from March 22nd until about the middle of April.
Yes. So for us in the West, you can see how difficult it is to try to remember and calculate a certain day. And the Chinese are doing the same way because theirs are lunar and solar, and they try to combine the two. That takes 19 years exactly to even out the lunar months with the solar years.
Okay, sounds like a tricky business for sure. So what is this? Is the year of the rooster, is that right?
Correct. This, as of January 28th, is the year of the rooster, but you do not change your animal sign until approximately February 3rd or 4th. That is the Chinese solar side of the calendar, and that remains pretty constant. Otherwise, you will have too many roosters and not enough monkeys this year or next year. So the Chinese were aware of that because the zodiac animals were involved in matching people for marriage. You don't want too many of one year and not enough of the other year. So the Chinese really used a solar calendar to determine your zodiac animal. And I've just given away my whole talk for Saturday.
You'll get more than that into the hour, I'm sure. So that's at 1 o'clock on Saturday. And Chelsea, what time are you speaking on Saturday and about what?
We're going to be out at the actual excavation site from 12 to 2. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to try to do is set up above ground what we think the house looked like based on our archaeological excavations below ground. So we'll show the way the house was laid out. We'll have artifacts that we found. We'll have a lot of different information about what we think that house would have been like to walk into it on September 11th, 1888, before it burned.
Wow. So you just got back from a trip to southern China, is that right? From where most of the people came to the United States from.
Yeah, I got to spend a month in Guangdong Province in Kaiping, which is one of the four counties, which is where a lot of the folks came from in the 19th and 20th, early 20th century. And it was an amazing experience, and I feel like I have to go back through and relook at all my notes because now I have such a different perspective, which is, you know, long overdue to kind of understand what the villages that these folks would have come from so that I can better understand the homes that they built over here.
Sounds wonderful. Okay, so you'll be at the excavation site. Where in Jacksonville?
We are going to be, it's in on Main Street, just past the corner of Oregon and Main, kind of behind La Fiesta, next to the Veterans Park, and okay. There's a fountain there.
All right, and Don Merritt, when is the Kam Wah Chung State Heritage Site open? When can people visit?
Well, our first day is going to be May 1st, and we're open until October 31st, and we run daily tours. On the hour, starting at 9 in the morning, and the last one's at 4 in the afternoon.
And people can combine it with an eclipse trip, because I think the eclipse is going to pass right over John Day, isn't it?
It is, and we're expecting anywhere from 20,000 to 50,000 people coming through this area, so it could be a busy day.
That's in August. We'll be talking again. Don Merritt is the museum curator at the Kam Wah Chung State Heritage Site in John Day. Chelsea Rose is a researcher at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. David Lay, a historian, dancer, art patron, board member of the Center for Asian American Media at the University of California, Berkeley. David and Chelsea appearing at Chinese News. New Year ceremonies in Jacksonville on Saturday. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. This has been really fun.